When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The information depicted in this podcast is purely for informational purposes only. Please consult your healthcare professional before making any changes to your lifestyle or routine.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Boost Your Biology podcast. My name is Lucas, and I am the founder of Ergogenic Health. Together in this podcast series, we will go underground to explore cutting-edge health and human performance insights that you simply cannot search on Google to help you upgrade your existence. So, without any further ado, let's jump into today's episode. What's up, fam? Lucas here. I want to take a moment to announce a couple of things to all my new listeners on the podcast. Firstly, if you're looking to upgrade your brain function, whether that be through reducing brain fog, enhancing verbal fluency, improving confidence, motivation, drive, or even orgasm intensity, then check out my nootropics course, which can be found on my website at www.ergogenic.health. And you'll see at the top, it will say courses, where you can use the discount code BYB15 to save 15% off. In addition, I also have a sleep optimization masterclass and a testosterone optimization course that can also be accessed on my website. Again, you can use the same discount code BYB15 to save 15% off. What's up, guys? And today I am super excited because I have what I believe to be one of the world's leading experts on body recomposition, muscle growth, and fat loss. He is actually one of the smartest researchers in the space of sports nutrition and training. And joining me in today is Christopher Barakat. Welcome to the show, man.
Thanks for having me on, man. It's a very humbling introduction, but I appreciate it.
I've been following your work quite closely. When I first started my Instagram, you were one of the early pages I started following and started learning from. So yeah, hats off to you, man. You've actually, you've taught me a lot, and I'm sure millions of other people. So do you want to give my audience a bit of a summary or a synopsis of your background?
For sure. Thanks a lot, man. So essentially, just to kind of kick it back and give you a quick general overview, I was always into physical fitness of some sport. When I was super young, I was really into martial arts. Then I was obsessed with basketball throughout my middle school, high school years. And then after high school, I got really involved with bodybuilding. So I competed in 2011 as a teenager, and that kind of changed the trajectory of my academic experience and what I really wanted to study and pursue. So I studied athletic training, which was, you know, a real focus on sports rehab and emergency care and stuff like that. And I thought I was going to go the physical therapy route, but after working so many years in physical therapy clinics and diving deeper and deeper into the bodybuilding world and the coaching space, I just wanted to study exercise and nutritional sciences. So I ended up getting my master's in that from the University of Tampa. And immediately post-graduation, they hired me on to continue doing research there and to teach there part-time. So I do that kind of part-time, full-time, and then I coach, you know, full-time. So those are my main things. I'm very deeply involved with the competitive natural bodybuilding space. But once I got involved in the research world as a grad student, I kept seeing this recomposition phenomenon occur in a lot of our subjects. And it wasn't something that people in the evidence-based space were talking about. So I kept seeing this observed in our lab. And then I was looking at multiple research studies from all over the world. And these results were demonstrated from the other studies, but it wasn't really part of the discussion. Like, they would just talk about the muscle being gained, and they weren't really talking about, you know, either some of the subjects or the group averages losing fat throughout the training intervention. So that really caught my eye, because at the end of the day, people don't just want to lose weight. They want to improve body composition. And there's plenty of times where I work with my clients and we get started and their weight is not moving much at all, but their physique looks way different and they're losing inches around their waist. So we know that they're losing fat and building muscle at the same time. But in those situations, we don't have the objective data from assessment tools like a DEXA scan or a bioelectrical impedance or something fancy, but we clearly see it in the photos and we see it through their waist circumference measurements and stuff like that. So yeah, man, this past September of 2020, our research review paper that I led came out on body recomposition, and it really was the first scientific paper that covered, you know, gaining muscle and losing fat at the same time. So that really took off and kind of made a lot of noise in the evidence-based space.
Yeah, it's definitely it's a topic that's sort of been brought up numerous times throughout, like, various PTs and muscle building experts always talk about, oh, look, is it possible to build muscle and burn fat at the same time? So it's amazing sort of to see that you've been involved in sort of pioneering that sort of research. So do you want to maybe explore that with our audience, what you found in that study?
Yeah, for sure. So I'll take it a couple steps back. A lot of people in the evidence-based space, they would admit or they would acknowledge that people can lose fat and build muscle at the same time, especially if they're beginners or if they were obese to start. They wouldn't really argue that, right? But they would say you have to be in a caloric surplus or you have to be in a calorie deficit, and you need to be focusing on either fat loss or muscle building, and you shouldn't really aim to do both at the same time if you're, you know, an intermediate or advanced trainee. And there are certain components to that where there is some merit, but it's so misunderstood and so many people are leaving a lot on the table because they're not optimizing their variables, that I genuinely believe like 90% of the people you see at any commercial gym can undergo a recomp. So I'm assuming the majority of the people listening to this can. Now, if you're an elite athlete, you're extremely advanced and you're like a high level bodybuilder, yeah, your goal should be, okay, I'm going to be in a surplus and I'm in a massing phase, or okay, I'm in a fat loss focus phase. But literally, like, if I go to a normal LA Fitness commercial gym down the street from me, I would be confident that I can get like 90% of the people in there to recomp if they executed everything I told them to do. So what happened was when I was in graduate school in 2016, we ran a study that had nothing to do with body recomposition. It was looking at training interventions, autoregulation of exercise selection, and how that would impact muscle gain and strength gain. So we primarily reported lean body mass changes from the DEXA scan, as well as their strength performance changes. But when looking at that research a bit deeper, and when I was analyzing each individual, and I had all the raw data in front of me, I saw that, I believe, 6 or 7 out of like the 18 subjects went through this recomp phenomenon. I was like, that's pretty freaking cool that you know, they gained lean body mass and lost fat mass at the same time. Like, that's what everyone wants to do. So essentially that happened. And then literally 3-4 months later, we run a study on our volleyball team and the recomp was insane. They gained like 6 pounds of lean mass and lost 6 pounds of fat mass on average in only a 7-week time frame. So I was just like, sure. So I thought that was like super epic. And then as the years went on, I saw more data being published. Actually, one study was from USF from my man, Dr. Bill Campbell. He was looking at like aspiring female physique competitors, and they had a high protein group and a low protein group. And the high protein group built more muscle and lost more fat over that 8 or 10 week training period. So I just kept seeing it over and over. I'm like, man, I need to write a review paper about this and go through the entire body of literature and see what I can put together. So the study kind of evaluated previous research interventions and research studies that were done. And then I kind of gave an overview on what we saw and what we observed.
Mm. Just jumping back a second, you sort of mentioned Bill Campbell's study where they were looking at in women, how high with the protein did they go?
Off the top of my head, I believe they went up to 2.2 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. So it wasn't insane.
Yeah.
But they labeled that their high protein group, and then they had a lower protein group that might have been like the RDA, maybe 0.8 grams per kilogram of body weight, I believe. So I think those were the numbers. But yeah, the cool thing too, they showed individual data points for that. And not one subject in the high protein group lost any lean mass. Everybody gained, but people gained at different levels, different magnitudes.
Right.
In the low protein group, some people lost lean body mass while losing total body weight, even though they were undergoing a resistance training program. So that's like the last thing you want, right? You want to make sure you're preserving as much lean mass as possible. So we know that, you know, moderate to high protein diets are super important depending on your level of physical activity and what your goals are. There's been a lot of cool research on that if you want to chat about that a bit.
Oh, absolutely. Let's delve into some of the recommended ranges. Like, I know you mentioned 2.2 kilograms. I've heard the number 1.6 to 2.2 floating around a lot per kilogram of body weight. But do you want to delve into that a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, the International Society of Sports Nutrition, they use a range between like 1.6 to 2.2, which I think is good depending on what athletic endeavor you're participating in, how much muscle protein breakdown is actually happening from your sport or training activity, and like what your goals are. I'm not the biggest fan of just using body weight, and I'll explain that in a minute. But, you know, there's a huge difference between a cross-country runner, a basketball player, and somebody that's bodybuilding. So muscle protein breakdown is going to be way higher in somebody that is resistance training at high volumes, at high intensities, right? So it's going to vary depending on the sport and the goal. But more importantly, I like utilizing lean body mass as your determinant for how much protein you need. So if I told an obese individual, let's say we have a 200, should I use pounds or kilograms?
Go kilograms. Yeah.
Kilograms. So let's say we have a 100 kilo person.
Yep.
I'm not going to tell them to consume 2.2 kilograms of protein. 2.2 grams per kilogram of body weight. Wow. I'm not going to just prescribe them 220 grams of protein per day if they're 100 kilos. And let's just say they're at, you know, 20% body fat. So they might only have 165 pounds of lean mass or so. I like using lean body mass as their reference points for how much protein they need. So my recommendation is 1.2 grams to 1.6 grams of protein per pound of lean body mass. And the more body fat you have, the closer to the 1.2 you should be, the less protein you need. And then the leaner you are and the more physically active you are, the closer to that 1.6 gram per pound of lean body mass you can be. So it's kind of like a sliding scale depending on your situation, your level of activity and your body composition, but that's the scale. And it's not a huge scale, 1.2 to 1.6. I mean, you can just say 1.4 for everybody. Yeah. but that's grams per pound of lean body mass.
Yeah.
So just as a reference, you know, I weigh 185 pounds and I eat anywhere from 220 protein to 250 protein. So my protein's pretty high.
Mm. Can we, let's backtrack a little bit. I know you mentioned this term lean body mass now, and you've also mentioned the DEXA scan, which I've personally done myself. It is the gold standard of, you know, body composition analysis. So let's talk about, for those who don't have access to the DEXA, is there any other way to determine lean body mass?
Yeah. So the DEXA is awesome. It's definitely the gold standard for bone mineral density, and it's pretty darn good for body composition, lean mass and fat mass and everything like that. So essentially lean body mass are things like your tissue, anything that's fat free. So tissue, bone, organs, stomach, blood volume, all that stuff. And even water is going into a lot of lean compartments and lean tissue. So if you don't have access to a cool tool like a DEXA, you absolutely still can guesstimate your lean body mass. The worst case scenario is looking at yourself in the mirror and looking at people that have been tested. Like, you can type in Google body fat percentages and they'll show you pictures of people at 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20, 22, 24. And you can just get an idea of where you might be just compared to other people that have been tested. But a really easy way to do it is doing the skin fold, the skin caliper assessment. Yeah, it can vary if you have experience or don't have experience, but doing a 3-site skin fold assessment or a 7-site skin fold assessment is a pretty darn good tool to get a good range of what your body fat percent is and how much lean mass you have and how much fat mass you have. So was you can that, literally guesstimate visually, or you can actually test yourself.
Yeah, you mentioned the 3-point versus 7-point, the skin fold testing. Which one does Charles Poliquin, I know he has like a particular, which one was he using?
I'm assuming he would be using the 7-site. So you have, yeah, the Jackson Pollock is the formula for that. Yeah. The 7-site's more accurate than the 3-site. A lot of times the 3-site is like right next to your belly button, your tricep and your calf or your thigh. So it's like one from your trunk, one from your upper body, and then one from your lower limb. But the 7-site's way more accurate, where you're doing essentially next to your belly button, close to your hip, in between your armpit and your hip, your chest, your subscap area, your thigh, your tricep. So it's way more detailed. And that is kind of important because we all store our body fat quite differently. You know, some people maintain pretty lean trunks and they might, you know, have a 6-pack year round, where other people, they can be really lean in their arms and shoulders, but they store a ton of fat around their midsection and their love handle area. So
yeah,
the more sites you have, the more accurate it would be.
Yeah. I want to share my results to my audience real quick with the DEXA. Sure. My reading came back at 14.1% total body fat. And I had so many guys message me saying, oh, there's no way that's correct. You're much lower. And that's purely because, like, I'm pretty lucky with genetic wise. Mm. I don't store any fat on the abdominal area at all, but everything goes to like the buttocks or like other, or my back and stuff.
Yeah.
Again, we can't, and this is true, right? Like, we cannot decide where body fat, we cannot spot fat reduce. You know, so like, I think that's just more genetic component to it.
100%. The only thing you can do is develop more muscularity in that area, so that area kind of looks leaner than it is, or more muscle is poking through the skin and pushing against the skin. So like, I actually store a decent amount of body fat in my midsection, but I also don't have good muscularity of my rectus abdominis. Like, it's not a well-developed muscle. So that also works against me, and I need to be pretty darn lean for my abs to look pretty good. So yeah, there's a huge genetic component to it.
Yeah. There was a period of time, I think it was for 2 years straight, I was just treating abs like any other muscle group, and I was absolutely destroying them. Like, I'd do like a 1-hour workout and be sore for literally 5 days. I'd just absolutely destroy them. And I think it's actually caused overproduct. My abdominals are actually, they look stupid, man. They're just like
that's sick.
Yeah,
That's what I need to start doing. I'm going to do a 1 hour ab workout tomorrow morning.
Yeah, you'll be literally, I stay sore for like 4 to 5 days. I just nuke them.
I need to step up my game there, because abs is that one thing I don't enjoy training, unfortunately. So, and it's a weak spot on my physique. So it's really what I need to do for competitive purposes, not for just like, not to look good, but like literally so I do better when I compete next time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's sort of segue back to like protein. So I want to talk about, and this is something that I've always wanted to know personally, is like, let's say you're not hitting that required amount of protein to build muscle, but you've upped your carbohydrates significantly. Like what's going to happen in that scenario?
Yeah. So there's one thing I want to mention that's, I think, super important. A lot of people think if you eat a high protein diet and you're in a calorie surplus, you're going to gain muscle.
Yeah.
You can eat 300 grams of protein per day and be in a surplus and still build zero muscle if you don't have a training stimulus.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, really important, because you can also build muscle eating way less protein as long as you're like progressing in the gym. And there's a huge genetic component to that. But just because your protein is high does not mean you're guaranteed to build muscle. On the opposite end, like going back to the question, if you reduce your protein, you're kind of not hitting like an optimal protein intake for yourself, and the majority of those calories are coming from carbohydrate. I mean, a few things can happen. You might be slightly under recovered because maybe your muscle protein breakdown is greater than your muscle protein synthetic responses. So from a, like a nitrogen standpoint, you might be in a deficit in that sense. Like you don't have enough nitrogen and amino acids coming in to properly recover. So that's a possibility. But at the same time, if you're getting a ton of carbohydrate, at least you're kind of ensuring that your glycogen levels should be full, and your performance should be good on that side of the spectrum. Like at least the one piece of the puzzle is in a decent place. But yeah, essentially you're just hindering your recovery and your performance, and therefore you're probably hindering the adaptation outcomes that come through the training and through the recovery.
Right. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing about that is like, it just, when I watch those movies and like, I see like prison, you know, prison inmates, they're doing like a shit ton of body weight training, like calisthenics, things like that. But yeah, there's no way they're hitting their protein intake, right? Like how?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. I hear you there. And it's funny, man, because when I was kind of sifting through the literature, I would see some, like going back to that volleyball study where those girls gained 7 pounds of lean mass and lost like 6 pounds of fat mass or whatever just in 7 weeks' time. Their protein intake wasn't crazy high by any means. It was definitely sufficient, but it was like way lower than me, right? But I think one thing is they're college volleyball players that, yeah, they resistance train for strength and conditioning purposes, but like they're not bodybuilders. So they're, you know, further away from their genetic potential when it comes to their muscle building capabilities. So they're able to build muscle at a faster rate because they're less experienced. You know, they have experience, but they're not like advanced weightlifting athletes. They're volleyball players that resistance train to help them with their volleyball game, right? So it's really interesting. I think the more advanced you become, you might need more protein to facilitate your growth or to kind of maximize and make sure you're as supportive as possible with it.
Mm. Yeah. Let's sort of discuss a little bit on the role that protein plays in affecting fat mass. Like how does increasing one's protein take affect thermogenesis and fatness?
Yes. Awesome question. So we know that the three components of total daily energy expenditure, your caloric output, comes from your resting metabolic rate, right? Your physical activity and your NEAT, so your non-exercise activity thermogenesis, and your actual conscious intentional exercise and activities. And then the last thing is the thermic effect of food. And we know that protein has the highest thermic effect, and there have been some really cool protein overfeeding studies done by Antonio and colleagues, Jose Antonio out of Nova Southeastern here on the other side of Florida. And there are some studies that have shown subjects eating 500 more calories per day than their counterparts, but it was all coming from protein, and they gained more lean mass and they lost more fat mass compared to their counterparts that were eating less protein. And their counterparts that were eating less protein were still eating like a high protein diet. But this study was literally like intentionally doing excessive protein. They did 3.4 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight. So it was a very, very high protein diet. But it seems like that thermic effect of protein is increasing their energy expenditure to a certain degree. And they're also getting all these extra amino acids that can be utilized for things like protein synthesis. So it's kind of like a win-win. Again, for those that are dieting, eating more protein is also amazing because it's the most satiating macronutrient.
Yep.
So if hunger is one of those things that decreases your adherence, eating more protein is going to keep you fuller for longer, and it should improve your adherence as long as like you enjoy eating the protein you're enjoying and you're making it fun and tasty and the whole nine, like something that's sustainable. But the science behind it is there. The evidence is there. We don't fully understand like exactly why, but we see that it's producing positive outcomes.
Yeah. Curious to know, Chris, have you delved into any of the research around vegetarian protein sources versus meat at all?
To a certain extent, I recall one study off the top of my head. It was in older subjects. They compared a omnivore diet to a vegetarian diet while these people were resistance training, but it was older people. And I do know that the omnivore diet had more gains in lean mass and more fat loss, and the vegetarians or vegans actually lost a little bit of lean mass and like whatever, the body composition outcomes weren't as good. However, I will say if you are consuming complete protein sources and you're getting in enough total quantity as well as good quality, you should be successful on it. It's just way more difficult. I think vegan protein powders are awesome. Like when you have a rice and pea protein blend, it's the same amino acid profile as whey protein. So you're getting all of your essential amino acids. You're getting a high amount of leucine. You're getting a good amount of those branch chain amino acids that are really important for protein synthesis. You just digest it way slower. And unfortunately, it's way more expensive. So for vegans and vegetarians, that's literally like the only demographic of people that I recommend branch chain amino acid supplementation. For 99% of the population, it's a total waste of money.
Yeah.
But for vegans and vegetarians, let's just say you get like 18 to 20 grams of protein in a meal instead of like 25 to 35. If you took like 5 to 8 grams of BCAAs with that meal, like supplemented with it, you would maximize the protein synthetic response.
Yeah.
And you would be way better off. So it's like one of the only supplements, or one of the only times I actually recommend that supplement. Otherwise, you're better off, like you're flushing your money down the toilet for the most part.
It's crazy, man. Cause I just did a post on the, detrimental effects on BCAAs in terms of it affecting neurotransmitters, dopamine, serotonin, and then also, how it can affect insulin sensitivity, although there's only like 3 or 4 studies on that. But it's a good point. Like for the vegans, adding in that additional BCAA content on top of their diet that's lacking, it just makes sense. Yes. Really just making it for what they're not getting in. Interesting.
Yeah, for them, I really do think it's worth it. 5 grams with a meal. I almost feel like, man, if that was a long-term study, like a 10 to 12-week study where they had vegans that were supplementing with BCAAs and then non-vegans and omnivores, I really do believe the results would be extremely similar. That would be cool to see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Well, we need some vegan group to fund that.
Yeah, I don't know. There's plenty
of
Where's
the vegan money at?
Yeah. What about, I'd love to hear your thoughts on like the differences between fasted cardio versus non-fasted cardio. Like what's your personal stance on this topic?
Yeah. So I actually, my colleague, Dr. Guillermo Escalante and I, we wrote a review paper on this. So it's an open access paper. You guys can check it out.
Sweet.
And man, fasted cardio versus fed cardio. When looking at the literature, there really isn't much of a difference in terms of net fat loss. Okay. Literally no study has ever shown any statistically significant differences. But there's a caveat to it. So all of those studies were done in obese or overweight individuals. We can't take those results and apply it to super lean individuals. We shouldn't carry over those results and assume it would be the same thing. And I would also say that in some studies, there was a small effect size difference where there was like a slight trend that favored the fasted cardio to a small, small degree. However, you know, a lot of these studies were like 8 weeks long. Now, if you extended that same exact study, but it was 16 weeks long, that effect size magnitude might have grown and it might have been statistically significant over a longer period of time. So these are some things that I like hypothesize. But with all that said, regardless of what the results are, I think I don't tell people it's better than fed cardio ever because there's no data to support that. I'd be talking out of my butt if I said that. But I do think it's still an option and a tool. If people prefer to just wake up and get it out of the way, I think it also improves your mood right off the bat just by getting your day started with physical activity. You're going to release some of those, you know, feel good, you know, serotonin and dopamine is going to be upregulated and stuff like that. So it can just start your day on a positive note. And then for some people, it can improve their adherence. You know, if they say, hey, I'm going to work my 9 to 5 and then I'm going to do 45 minutes of cardio at 5 PM. But, you know, dinner's waiting for them at home or they have some other family obligation or they're just burnt out from the workday. They might say, man, I'm just going to go home today. I'm not doing my cardio. Mm-hmm. So if they did it at 7 AM and they just cranked it out of the way, they didn't miss it. So it could improve adherence for some people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some of my clients do fasted cardio. Some of my clients do fed cardio. A lot of times I leave it up to them. I personally like doing fasted cardio when I'm contest prepping. Yep. I just like getting it out of the way. I will say if you are doing fasted cardio, for the most part, you probably want to do like a low intensity steady state, something where you're not actually trying to like improve your performance on. And your primary goal is like, hey, I'm just trying to burn some extra calories and increase my expenditure. Then cool, do a little bit of lifts. If you're doing cardio for performance benefits and like you want to A, improve your cardiovascular fitness to the largest extent possible, and or you want to like improve your endurance performance, you will perform better when you're fed. So if that's your goal, you probably should be fed. You know what I'm saying? Like no track athlete is going to like not eat before their event. Like they want to make sure they're fueled, right? So depends why you're doing your cardio, but I am an advocate for it, I think. And I do think there may be an advantage to it depending on the population and the demographic and the context.
Yeah. Well, it's a great way to summarize it because there's a lot of confusion around the topic. I'm similar to you in that regard. I actually do like doing low intensity, steady state. I've got my treadmill desk. I do 10,000 steps first thing in the morning as soon as I get up. And it definitely, like you said, it does help with the mood and productivity. I feel great when I do it.
Sure. How long does it take you to do 10,000 steps?
About an hour 45.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's
like 45 minutes to an hour or like an hour and 45 minutes?
An hour and 45 minutes. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a long time, man.
It is. But it's like, well, once I get it out the way, it's like, now I can go like get my first big meal in. And I've already just did that. It's like perfect.
Do you read while you're on the treadmill or like, what do you do?
Dude, I'm smashing out work. I'm taking consults. Like it's, okay. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. Yeah. That's, at least you're killing two birds with one stone.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah. Or multiple birds. It sounds like you're doing a lot of things during that hour 45. So that's cool. If I was just like on a treadmill, like not doing anything, I'd be like, oh, okay, this needs to stop.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. Cause, I did experiment with like just carb backloading at the start of lockdown. I'm like, I might just change things up a bit. Let's see what impact carb backloading has on my performance. And I'm actually curious to hear your thoughts on this sort of this protocol. Have you ever personally tried it yourself?
I never really did true carb backloading. I have, so there's been multiple periods in my life where my first meal would just be high fat, high protein, and like fibrous vegetables. But I would never wait until like 2, 3, or 6 p.m. to start my carbs. So it was just meal one,
right,
would be high fat, fiber, and high protein. So it would usually be a vegetable egg omelet with like turkey bacon. So it'd be like, you know, onions, garlic, pepper, broccoli, whatever it may be, spinach, and then like a lot of whole eggs, like 5 to 6 whole eggs and a couple of pieces of turkey bacon.
Yeah.
So I've done that a lot. But then like my next meal has carbs in it. So I would say I never done like true carb backloading. I don't think there's, honestly, I don't think there's any advantage to it per se. I think people need to take into consideration, when are they most physically active? If your carbs should be highest around your activity. So, you know, if you're training at 7 p.m. after work or 6 p.m. after work, then yeah, the larger carb meal should be around then, like later in the evening. But if I was training at 7 a.m., I would definitely carb load immediately post-workout and everything like that. So it's very context dependent. I do think there can be an advantage regardless of what time of day you're eating the majority of your carbs. I do think there is an advantage to potentially having one meal per day that is high fat, high protein, high fiber, and very low carb, where you're just getting like fibrous vegetable. I think that's just like a good potential habit to build. And it also kind of gives your body an opportunity, like it doesn't require insulin levels to increase after every single feeding.
Yeah.
It's giving your body an opportunity to not potentially use glucose as the primary fuel source, and you might be actually burning fat as your primary fuel source, where, you know, a larger percent of the energy being expended at that time is actually coming from fat rather than carbs. So I do think there can be an advantage there. But the scientific evidence is really, really weak, if anything at all. So I think personal preferences come into play, and, you know, experiment with it. If you like it, stick with it. If you don't like it, you know, go back to your old habits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, let's, out of curiosity again, with carbohydrate intake, when you're, let's say, in a bulking phase, I know you probably kept your protein, you kept it maxed out at what, like 2.2 grams per kilogram in a bulking phase?
My protein, yeah. I've never gone over 250.
Yeah. Yeah.
250 grams per day. Just not really realistic and feasible to me.
Yeah.
When I do 250, I just try to do 5 meals at 50 grams. So that's what it typically looks like for me. Sometimes it's a little lower, like I might do a couple meals at 40 and a couple meals at 60, but generally speaking, it's just 5 meals at 50.
Well, what about all the bro science out there that says you can only absorb 28 grams of protein per meal?
Yeah, really bad information, that super common myth, you know, that should be addressed. I think the reason that started is because there is a anabolic threshold where consuming more protein isn't necessarily more anabolic on muscle tissue, but your body will absolutely digest, absorb, and assimilate every gram of protein that you put in it. So there's a number for that. There's a certain amount of leucine that you can consume in a meal, and it's going to maximize the protein synthetic response. So that number is actually 0.045 grams of leucine per kilogram of body weight. So it's relative to your size. I already know what it is, like how it breaks down for me based on protein sources. So I'll just give you guys like a quick list, like a quick example.
Sure.
So for someone that's like 180 pounds like me, if I consume 35 grams of whey protein, that's going to maximize my protein synthetic response because whey is very, very high in leucine and the branched chain amino acids. So if I have 35 grams of protein or 55 grams of protein, the 55 grams of protein didn't increase muscle protein synthesis to a larger degree than the 35 grams. However, it might have prolonged the duration of it because I had more total amino acids.
Right.
But it didn't like, the way I explain muscle protein synthesis is it's not an on and off switch. It's actually a dimmer. So just think about putting the light bulbs on a dimmer switch. If I eat 15 grams of protein, of high quality protein, I'm still going to turn on muscle protein synthesis just to a very small degree. So the lights are going to go on the room, but it's going to be really dim. If I hit that 35 gram of whey protein mark, the lights are going to go all the way on. So maximizing protein synthesis. And then like the more protein you have, you can be prolonging how long the lights are staying on.
Yeah.
Makes sense. And then it's different for food sources. So if I were to have chicken, I would need closer to like 48 grams of protein from chicken because there's not as much leucine in chicken compared to whey. Same thing for steak and salmon. So yeah, that varies on size. If I was like a 120 pound bikini girl, you know, I can get away with 22 grams of whey. I don't need 35 grams. There's a really cool study. I believe it was done in the UK. McNaughton and colleagues, they finally compared. And another reason this occurred was the first scientific evidence about like post-workout protein for protein synthetic response. For MPS purposes, it was literally done on one body part performing one exercise. So they would have subjects do like bilateral leg extensions, just a normal knee extension. Maybe they're doing like four sets of 15, and you have to take a muscle biopsy and measure the protein synthetic response pre and post. So it's a very invasive process, but it lacked ecological validity because they only trained one muscle group and they only trained one exercise. Mm-hmm. These other researchers said, well, that's not how people actually work out. What if we do a whole body workout? We do bench press, we do pull downs, we do lateral raises, and we do leg press. So we did legs, we did upper body. They found that the group consuming 40 grams of whey did have a higher protein synthetic response compared to the group having 20 grams for whey. And that's a much more realistic scenario. You're training more muscle groups. You're creating more muscle protein breakdown, right? You're creating more damage. So you need more protein to recover post-workout. Mm. So I think part of it was just poor information from just like society, like fitness magazines, whatever it may be, or like bros in the gym, like old school thoughts. And then also like the first pieces of evidence that we saw in the scientific literature wasn't looking at the whole puzzle. It was like a very zoomed in snapshot, and people were like taking that information and running with it rather than like critically thinking and saying like, well, hey, is that the entire piece of the puzzle?
Fascinating. Okay. Well, out of curiosity again, Chris, what areas of research within exercise science realm or nutrition, which areas are you like really excited to see more research on, or like really desperate to see more research on?
Man, a lot of people, at least in the space I'm in, they want to see more research on advanced lifters and advanced bodybuilders. It would be cool to see that, but I genuinely do not believe it's ever going to happen. The reason for that is there's so many bodybuilders here in Tampa where I live, right? And if I told them, hey, I want to run a really cool study on the highest trained individuals for 8 to 10 weeks, and you need to come to the lab 3 days per week, you need to do the exact workout that I prescribe to you, and you're not allowed to train outside of the lab at all, they're going to do this to me. They're going to say, I like my training. I'm going to keep doing what I want to do. And that's what happens. And it's so funny because they're like the advanced bodybuilder on social media is the first one to like critique research and like, oh, well, that's an untrained people or like moderately trained or like intermediate level people or just like normal college students that have been lifting for, you know, 1 to 4 years. They're like, that's not me. I've been lifting for 8 years or 12 years and like I'm advanced and yada, yada. It's like, yeah, I understand that. And there's so many researchers around the world that would love to investigate people like you, but you won't participate for 8 to 10 weeks and actually stop doing what you're currently doing and listen to us. So I don't think it's going to change, but it would be cool to see. Like the only thing I'm doing now with super high level athletes is case studies, but it's still N equals one. It's not like comparing this exercise intervention to that exercise intervention. It's just gathering everything they're doing and then putting it out there so people can see what they're doing and like what results they're producing based on what they're doing.
With those N equal one studies, like the case studies you're doing now, what's something unique you've noticed so far, like about these advanced lifters?
Well, it's pretty cool, man. So this is kind of just getting underway, but I'm actually comparing enhanced bodybuilders to natural bodybuilders.
Awesome.
So I'm really cool. I'm really excited to see how how the process is different during a contest prep. So when you have a natural person that's trying to get absolutely shredded, their ability to preserve their muscle mass is way harder. So I don't expect any of these like high level naturals to gain muscle and lose fat at the same time. I'm expecting them to just preserve as much as possible while losing fat and getting shredded. But a lot of them will lose some sort of lean body mass if they get like very, very lean. On the opposite end of the spectrum, I'm probably going to see some of these enhanced people not only preserve muscle, but I probably will see them gain muscle and lose fat at the same time, even though A, they're extremely advanced and B, getting to, you know, very, very low levels of body fat. And then from like a hormonal and physiological standpoint, I'm running blood work on them too. So I'm expecting to see a lot more, you know, quote unquote, negative hormonal adaptations occur to these naturals, whereas a lot of the advanced athletes are supplementing with exogenous hormones. So their lipids and their blood work is going to look way different compared to a natural athlete. So it'll be cool to see overall. It'll be nice. I'm trying to get like, you know, 5 to 8 really high level naturals and 5 to 8 really high level advanced athletes and do like singular case studies on them and then do a case series that compares both sides.
Yeah, that'll be really fascinating. A lot of people in my audience would love to see that sort of research. So when that comes out, man, just hit me up. I'll share that across my socials.
Thanks, man, for sure.
So, Chris, that pretty much wraps up the episode. I want to give my listeners a chance to see more of your work. I know you run the School of Gains. Is that correct?
Yes. That's like my educational platform. So when everything first started off, I just started off as a coach. My coaching brand, you know, originally is Competitive Breed, and that still exists for a lot of my competitive physique athletes. But I actually realized over time it was like intimidating to Gen Pop clients that really needed training and nutrition help. And I was making way more educational content in the nutritional and training realm. And I created the School of Gains because I teach at the university. I have the professor research background. And I also wanted it to be educational beyond things training and nutrition related. Like long term, I want it to be more holistic stuff. I want it to be more just life gains. I might even put like random financial blog articles up there, just like random stuff. Have podcasts with like experts of all different fields. So I just want people to make gains in every realm of their life kind of thing. That's my educational platform, man. It's just www.schoolofgains.com, and gains is spelled with a Z. And then on there, you'll find like free blog articles, free educational videos, and then my coaching with my team. So I have an RD on staff. I have 2 other coaches that work with me, and also my paid content. So my paid content's like my training schedule, my training programs and my nutrition ebook, The Ultimate Guide to Body Recomposition, that I did with Jeff Nippard. So that's a really cool resource that like gives you a step-by-step process on how to set up your diet and like the science behind it and why.
Mm.
So
amazing, man. Just for those listening in, Jeff Nippard is, he's probably one of the biggest fitness channels on YouTube, right? Like
100%. Yeah. He has over 2 million subscribers now on YouTube. Great. He's killing it.
Yeah.
Great. Super good content. Very educational stuff.
Awesome. Well, I'll be linking all of those resources in the show notes, guys. For those listening in, Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show, man. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure, man. Thanks for having me on. It was great, great conversation.
Awesome.
Thank you, everyone, for joining in to today's episode. For in-depth show notes and lessons learned, visit nofilter.media/boostyourbiology.
This has been a No Filter Media production.
Say what you want.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.